show you another where they would kill you for that same value. I think that maybe like societal values can be different from ethics, and a society can get really off track. And I think that's what's happened with kind of Western colonial society, is we have in placing ourselves somehow above the animals and the plants, and giving us this position of king and lord over all of nature, we've separated ourselves from the natural world. We've created a lot of trauma by doing so. And so now we're, you know, we're fighting with each other, and we're blowing each other up at, you know, and with scientific advancements making it more efficient to blow more people up, we've created this just disgusting society where everybody's just trying to hoard as much stuff as they possibly, well, not everybody, right? Because most people are altruistic. It's just, you know, that we've created this rampant capitalist system where a few people at the top have been allowed to hoard all of the resources for themselves while everybody else fights over the rest. So I guess what I'm saying is that we are human beings, especially like, you know, Western white colonial society, we've done such bad things that we're in such a state of trauma that I don't even know if people can sit down and especially people who are heads of corporations, they're not sitting down at night and thinking, oh my goodness, what's the right thing for me to do when I go into work tomorrow? They're going home and numbing the pain that they've created because of the cognitive dissonance that they've been living with their whole corporate lives. They're going home and they're, you know, drinking or, you know, whatever it is that numbs that gnawing guilt that's in their bellies.
Right. So the problem with, to bring it back to philosophy a little bit, the problem with relativism, cultural relativism or societal relativism, is that it becomes very difficult to criticize practices like oppressive colonial practices, or let's take other examples, let's say female genital mutilation, which has been an issue where in some African countries, or you know, femicide, where girls are killed because they've brought dishonor to the husband's family. Abhorrent practices like that become difficult to criticize if your position is that, well, cultures get to make their own decision about what's right or what's wrong. So it seems like you have to be able to find some universally or universalizable principles which apply to all cultures and all countries, and hold countries and cultures and societies and corporations and organizations accountable for wrongdoing. Because if simply by having certain values or promoting certain practices, a country or a society or a corporation makes those things right, that's just an untenable position.
It's but who gets
to circular, right?
Who gets the power to make the decisions?
Right. So that's the problem. But that's where the ethicist comes in and says, we have to find some sort of criteria, some objective criteria that transcend individual opinion that we can look to as the guide stick, as the guidepost.
Citizens' assemblies will do that, and they've been shown throughout history to do that. But what's happened is that our political systems are these, you know, by the time you get to run as a candidate for the NDP party, you have to be like towing the party line for 10 years and, you know, really like brown nosing up to all the right people and showing that you're going to be this, showing a track record of being an obedient servant to the master, right? And then you'll get tapped on the shoulder to be part of, so it doesn't really lead to, you know, people getting in those positions and acting in the interest of society, because they've been for the last sort of 10 years been acting in their own self-interest, right? So then it's hard to jump back to the other side. I agree that we need ethicists, and I agree that we need people trained in ethics. we need philosophers, but we're not creating any positions for them to do that. Now, citizens assemblies, if we ruled through citizens assemblies, binding, give power and pay, reasonable pay to these, it'd be like getting jury duty, you know, you'd call and go, okay, you got to come up and do a citizens assembly. And they would listen to the experts and the philosophers, and they would have all sorts of talks on these topics. And then they would be making the decisions. And you know, I think that there is, for the past, you know, kind of 4 or 5 years, I've been involved with civil disobedience campaigns, which are aimed at, you know, causing disruption so that it creates just, you know, like the suffragettes or the civil rights movement, disruptive, nonviolent actions that create a tension in society so that the government, people start talking about an issue and then the governments feel compelled then to do the right thing. And, you know, I'm looking it around and, you know, I'm not seeing all the, you know, ethics philosophers there out on the streets, you know, doing what's necessary for there to be radical change. You know, I'm seeing some teachers. I'm seeing a fair number of engineers, interestingly enough, and you know, all sorts of professions. But not, you know, there are a few people who are teaching in university. But you know, these people who've been studying ethics their entire adult lives, I would have thought they would be on the front lines of this. But no, the philosophy departments at universities are not hitting the streets. There is. I think that there's a problem with looking at academics to solve problems because, you know, like if people who had studied these issues and, you know, absolutely felt that they had a grasp on what is truly right to do, then the street would be filled with those people. But it's not. They're still. In fact, I remember when Save Old Growth was active in British Columbia, they were a civil disobedience campaign, and they were blocking streets and causing real disruption to people's everyday, you know, disrupting the rat race. And the part of their recruitment was to go into lecture halls and disrupt them, like walk in and say, I've got an announcement to make, we're, you know, and then they'd give a little talk for like, you know, 3 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever. And I'm pretty sure, I know it was some branch of moral philosophy, but I think that a lecture that they disrupted was, I think it was moral relativism. I think it was something like that. It was written on the board. And the professor was really upset. And he was like, get out of here. You're disrupting my lecture. Well, I would have thought, like, for anybody who's interested in really examining what's right or wrong, a bunch of activists who are involved in a civil disobedience campaign who are blocking traffic jump in. Like, that is a gift. That's a teachable moment there. Not like, wait a minute, get out of here while I, who've been nothing but sitting in my ivory tower and writing papers on moral relativism, you know, pontificate in front of these young people who are paying money to hear me blather on.
Okay, so what I'm understanding, Jillian, after our talk so far, is that in my view, we don't even have to go right to these specific issues in contention, fossil fuels, global warming, weapons of mass destruction. I mean, these are all legitimate issues, and I have not doubting your position on these issues. But we don't even have to go to those issues specifically to find ethical issues with the way the BC teachers' pensions are invested. So let me tell you what I've learned from you. But yeah, so the first problem is what you elucidated, which is that there is no directive or policy to take ethics into account, that it's supposed to be fiduciary, and then fiduciary is interpreted to mean lacking in any ethical content, but merely what's financially advantageous. So,
right. Which is ethical, not the dictionary definition, by the way.
Right. There's a problem there. That's one issue.
They've redefined what fiduciary means.
Right. Right. So that's one issue. Is that we can question whether it's ethically correct that there should be no attention paid whatsoever to the content, to the substance of what is done with this money. It just blindly put into wherever they believe, correctly or incorrectly, whatever these, you know, what bureaucrats or whoever believe is going to be financially advantageous. Although we might even take issue with that, right?
Yeah, I don't think that. Yeah. I don't think they're doing that anyway. I think what's probably happening is they're being told, or they also like BCI actually invests in its own corporations, right?
Even worse.
I believe there's, you know, we haven't looked specifically into the Teachers Pension Board, but when you do look closely at many of these boards, they often sit on more than one board, right? And they often will sit on the boards of fossil fuel corporations.
So they may not even be motivated by what they claim to be guided by, which is fiduciary responsibility, under even a redefinition of the term fiduciary.
Right.
So there's multi-level of problems there that are ethical problems with respect to integrity, honesty, and these are all ethical principles, right?
Yeah.
Honesty, integrity,
massive amounts of
responsibility
corruption.
In government.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can get into political philosophy and the principles behind democracy. You know, democracy, when you learn about, you know, political philosophy, is much deeper and much more complicated than simply the right to vote. It's the way that the government conducts its business. So here you have what at least quasi-governmental or crown corporations who, in a democracy, in a democratic country, would be obligated to operate in a way that is democratic. Democratic meaning things like transparent, accountable, rational in decision making, not beholden to special interests, but rather beholden to the people. So there's ethical questions here. There's political questions here. And that's without even getting to the specific issues, right? And where you started with specific issues, and we don't even have to go to those to find problems here with the way this system works. The second problem is lack of control, the lack of choice that the teachers have. These are the teachers. This is the teachers' money, right? So is it like matching funds? Some of the paycheck and also some matching funds from the government?
In our contract, we give 11.13% and the employer gives 11.3% or 11.4%. So it's like, I just take that extra 11.4% and, you know, my 11%, and I would be, if I had like $22,000 a year to invest in what I saw fit, I'd probably be doing okay right now after a 30-year teaching career.
Right, but you don't. And as I understand it, you have no choice if you want to keep your job, but to allow the Teachers Pension Plan and BCI to invest however they deem fit your money that you've earned. So there's an ethical problem here. This is a matter of choice, of personal freedom. Against your conscience, the fruits of your labor, your compensation, at least part of it, 11.3%, is being invested against your moral beliefs.
Funding my own extinction.
Environmental ethicists would argue that it's not a relativistic opinion that future generations are being harmed or the Earth is being harmed by global warming. It becomes an ethical imperative that we have an obligation to future generations. Intergenerational justice is not in this view, right? In the view of ethicists, credible ethicists, is not optional.
This massive bureaucracy has been allowed to flourish. And this is happening in every public entity, and I would imagine in a lot of private entities as well, but particularly our public, our public institutions like education and healthcare. It's been allowed to like proliferate so that all of these, you know, these like big teams of people just get together to figure out how to limit the power of the people who are working under them and, you know, increase management even more, increase their own salaries even more. Just this pilfering from the bottom up. And there's, you know, we've got a whole, like the world is full of people who are, you know, paid to influence, right? And so I find it really interesting. I've been following what's happening with Just Stop Oil in the UK, and they recently sprayed orange corn flour on Stonehenge. And everybody's just outraged, and it's really interesting how these these counter arguments come up about why they're wrong. And one came up about the very delicate lichen that are on Stonehenge, and any disruption to them will, you know, surely cause those lichen to die. And haven't these so-called environmentalists thought about the lichen? But then it's obviously such an incredibly constructed and stupid argument, because lichen are incredibly vulnerable to high temperatures, right? So it's like, I don't think they're under more danger from some orange cornflower than they are for it being 52 degrees for 3 weeks at a time, right? So this is like, you know, I think people are still talking about ethics, but nobody is asking them what they think. And if they do ask them what they think, it's just like this kind of, I don't know what you would call it. It's not greenwashing, like ethics washing. So they'll, we've consulted with the ethics board, and this is what we're going to do. But, you know, people are getting hired to these so-called ethics boards. And even if they give their opinion and their opinion is overturned, like they don't even listen to them. They're like, that's consultation. They're like, we consulted with our ethics board. Well, your ethics board might have said, stop producing fossil fuels, right? But that's just the duty to consult. And we went through this early in the, you know, when teachers had their contract ripped up, and the composition rules were thrown out. We used to have like composition rules where you could only have, let's say, 3 kids with special needs in any one class. Otherwise, the class had to be reduced in numbers. And so they came back and changed. It was like they could do it with consultation. And what was the consultation? The consultation was pulling you in to the office and saying, oh, okay, by the way, you have 5 kids who have special needs in this class, and it's a class of 30, and there's nothing we can do about it. So can you sign this piece of paper? And you're like, I'm not signing that piece of paper. I don't agree with it. But that was consultation. And so I think that's what's happening in the world, is that there's this veneer that's been constructed, that's consultation, and they really don't have any binding recommendations. I'd be totally down with the experts in ethics being given some decision-making power, but they're just
Although, as you pointed out earlier, we have to be careful about who we consider to be experts in ethics. To simplify it, there's sort of the masculine versus the feminine, right?
And that's where ethics. That's where we get to the citizens' assemblies, where they hear from a variety of experts and people from a variety of backgrounds and perspectives, and then they make the, you know, then they sit and talk about it, and they tend, and if there's, they have no skin in the game either way, right? They're just regular people who come from different walks of life, and they're listening to experts. And
so
they're,
let's talk about those citizen assemblies. So let's talk about that for a moment. None of us is God, right? None of us has a God's eye view to be able to determine what is right and what is wrong from God's point of view, if there were even a God, right? So the problem with ethics is that we're in a bind because we want to say that there are things that are inherently right and things that are inherently wrong. It's not purely relativistic. Countries, societies, corporations can simply be wrong no matter what they think. Even if they think they're right, they can still be wrong. So we're appealing to this idea as ethicists that there is some sort of objective, some sort of universal right and wrong, maybe not with respect to every issue, but at least certain principles are universal. And there might be societies or countries or individuals who don't abide by them, but it doesn't make them not valid. Doesn't make them wrong, or doesn't make something right merely because a society decides that it's right. So the question is, how do we discover what those overriding generalizable principles are? Since none of us is God, we can't appeal to God. We can't go talk to God and say, well, now, I know some people claim that they can, but I'm suggesting that we can't. So I'm suggesting that we have no access to God. Maybe there is no God. And we have to somehow be able to infer what these universalizable principles are. So how do we do it? So we do it through our ethics practices. One way is the masculine way that we talked about, which is weighing the pros and cons, the arguments on each side. Another is the more feminine approach, which is using an intuition, using care, using that kind of thing.
Principles of nonviolence.
Right, principles that seem to be intuitive rather than thought out in the head.
Nonviolence to self.
Right, and I was talking about how I have some of that when I'm simply opposed to killing, because it's killing and it's violent, and I don't need a logical argument, right?
So even though there are logical arguments. Superior, maybe it's not just not that it's feminist ethics. Right. Maybe it's just the superior.
Exactly. Maybe women have just discovered something that's itself universalizable.
Or maybe there's a reason that women's power has been, you know, diminished throughout history, and, you know, any matriarchal societies have been suppressed. And, you know, in Canada, many of our First Nations are matriarchal. And so I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's a mystery as to why violence against Indigenous women has been so incredibly condoned in our society. It's like they're really, you know, they're really powerful people. And there's one thing the patriarchy doesn't want. It's like a bunch of matriarchs mouthing
right,
off.
So to continue with my logical argument, which I think I will arrive at a place that's very agreeable to you, Jillian. I'm coming at it from a logical place here also, which is that if we agree that there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong, then it's got to be the case that with respect to fossil fuels, with anthropogenic global warming, with respect to the manufacture and sale of and usage of weapons of mass destruction, with respect to banking practices, all these issues that you brought up, right, with respect to logging, there's got to be some right and some wrong in all this. It's not simply a relativistic difference of opinion. It's not simply a difference of opinion about whether there's global warming or not. It's not a difference of opinion about whether we should manufacture weapons of mass destruction. It's not an honest difference of opinion about whether logging out the forest is right or wrong. There are actually to be discovered actual universalizable principles. Perhaps it is the case that the manufacture and sale of weapons of mass destruction is morally and ethically universalizably wrong. Clear-cut logging of our remaining old-growth forests in British Columbia is simply wrong. It's not a matter of opinion. It's simply wrong. So how do we discover this right and wrong, given that none of us has God?
But
what you're proposing is a method, is a strategy for trying to approach discovery, to trying to discover where the right and wrong is. It certainly can't be the case that it's ethically correct for teachers against their will, for their earnings to be invested in organizations or companies or governments that are doing the wrong thing ethically. That can't be right. That cannot be right.
But we
that
know
cannot
the answer,
be the case.
But there are a lot of people whose political future and financial future depend upon them acting in the best interests of the oligarchy.
And that doesn't make it right.
We agree on that.
It doesn't make it right.
And what I would say to these leaders, to anybody in any position of power, and, you know, we're talking about Clint Johnson, the president of the British Columbia Teachers Federation, is you have these leaders, you know, our premier, David Eby, you know, who has showed himself to be a real disappointment in the area of ethics. He used to be a civil rights lawyer, right? He literally wrote the book on civil rights in British Columbia. David Eby, who quite literally wrote the book on civil liberties in so-called British Columbia, you know, such a huge disappointment. I would say to these people is you have children. You have a moral responsibility to deal with this problem and do the right thing and not just be thinking in this short-sighted way about your donors and about maybe, you know, being able to run for political office or remaining in political office or whatever. You have a duty to the children of this world to make your decisions and use your voice based on what you believe to be right after doing some soul searching, right? After looking at the experts yourself and making a moral decision. They need to make decisions based on a sense of morality, not based on a sense of kind of selfish self-aggrandizement.
Right. Okay. So given, let's wrap it up here. So given substantial evidence, a very good argument that I think we both made that the current system is unethical for various reasons. Tell me again, in a nutshell, what your proposal is for a change, a modification to the way that BC teachers' pensions are invested. What's the community council? Tell me again what it is you're proposing, Jillian.
Right. Well, what we want is for the leadership of the British Columbia Teachers Federation to publicly state that they would like the Teachers Pension Plan Board to rewrite the SIP, the Statement of Investment Policies and Procedures, to reflect teachers' desire to divest from fossil fuel corporations and weapons corporations. This is, this is sort of a first step, and we would also like them to take this into account when they're appointing people to be on the pension committee. The pension board is chosen from the pension committee. So I and at least one other teacher with a wealth of divestment knowledge and a huge amount of knowledge of this pension applied for the two positions on the pension committee, and we were not selected. And maybe the people who were selected have a wealth of knowledge, but they have not attended any of our divestment seminars. I don't know who they are. I haven't seen them engage with our divestment campaign, so I'm assuming that they were not appointed based on their stated intent to push for divestment of our pensions. So I would like them also to change that policy and to be appointing people who are looking at ways to divest the pension. I'd like them to engage with the board, the half the board members that they have appointed. And I would like them to put this up as a priority, that we need to get this done.
In a nutshell, you're advocating for the democratization of the process rather than the lack of choice, sort of a dictatorial system that exists.
Yeah, I mean, I would really like the BCTF to become a much more democratic. I mean, that's a whole other 2-hour talk on why the BCTF is not particularly democratic. I did attend a new teachers seminar workshop, and I went with some information to hand out to the new teachers about their pensions and what their pensions are invested in, and I was actually asked to leave. I was kicked out for handing out unauthorized pamphlets.
Yeah. So BCTF stands for British Columbia
Teachers Federation. And I've been a member of this union and a staff rep for, since 1996, I've been a member of the BCTF. And so to get kicked out of the new teachers conference for trying to let the new teachers know what their pensions are invested in is just disgusting.
You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Michael Robert Cadiz. My guest today has been Jillian McGuire. Jillian is a BC public school teacher, co-founder of BCTF. That's the BC Teachers Federation Divest Now campaign. Thank you so much, Jillian.
All right. But any people at public pensions in BC, check out where your money's going, because you too are probably subsidizing the oil and gas and weapons industry.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Looking for a community who will support you on your academic journey? The Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all 3 SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca. Thank you.
Thank you.